Over the past 7 or 8 years, our oil imports have fallen from over 60% to 45%. And yet in 2012, we had record gasoline prices. And if that didn't show to Washington and to people that are thinking about energy security that the traditional paradigm, which is if we only reduce our oil imports, we're going to face lower oil prices. If that traditional paradigm was not proved to be completely wrong, then nothing will show it to be. We've been told for decades that if we only expand our domestic supply of oil and reduce our domestic consumption through fuel efficiency, then that's going to solve our problem. And we did that. That drop from over 60% to 45% wasn't just because of the recession-induced drop in demand. It was also because increased vehicle fuel efficiency and also because of this oil boom or boomlet that we're experiencing. But it didn't stop OPEC from seeing record oil revenues. And so I think we really need to re-examine the energy security paradigm that we've been dealing with. And that's why my colleague Gerluft, that I know many of you heard speak last year at this conference, and I wrote Petropoli, The Collapse of Conventional Oil Reserves. Yet together, they account for just a third of global oil supply. Now, if it was Exxon and Chevron and BP and Shell that were sitting on 78% of reserves, they wouldn't be at a third of supply, right? If they would be, they'd be facing antitrust action. But you can't bring antitrust action against sovereign regimes. And so we're facing a situation in which this cartel, which as a collective acts as a monopolist in the global oil market, is keeping its production capacity much below what it could be. And that's the fundamental reason oil prices are up. All prices are high because demand from the developing world, the growth in demand, is not met with the growth in supply from OPEC countries, even as non-OPEC countries are increasing production manyfold. And to understand the deepness of this issue, just realize that OPEC today produces exactly what it did 40 years ago. It has not increased its production over the last four decades. Now, what happened over the last year was the Arab Spring. And if you want to think about and understand where oil prices are going, then you need to understand that the deepest and most important factor in determining where oil price is going to be is the price required to balance the national budgets of the OPEC countries. What does the Arab Spring have to do with that? Well, the regimes that didn't collapse are the monarchies in the Gulf. And the Saudi king and the other princelings and kings in the area don't want to end up like Mubarak. They don't want to end up in a glass cage on trial, nor do they want to have their heads separated from their necks. And so what they did in response to the Arab Spring is lavish subsidies on their subjects. Drastically increase subsidies for food, for fuel, increase salaries. Most of the folks in those countries work for the government, increase government salaries. And so the regime's budgetary expenditure is drastically increased. At the same time, what is the input into that budget? It's energy sales, it's oil sales. And so if you look at the budgetary requirements of Saudi Arabia, moving forward, and you also think about the fact that you have a burgeoning population, and you also understand that the sixth largest consumer of oil, when we wrote the book was published just a couple months ago. At that point, the sixth largest consumer of oil was Saudi Arabia. Sixth largest consumer of oil in the world. Well, today it's the fifth largest. So its internal oil consumption is growing very much, and that means it's exporting less oil to the market. That means OPEC countries as a whole have less oil to sell, and that means they need to see a higher price for that oil. So oil price is going to go up. It's not going to go up in a straight line, but it is going up, absent competition from other commodities. And that's where we get to you all and to other hardworking, patriotic Americans throughout the country in other energy sectors that could give OPEC a run for its money. Because the issue here isn't just OPEC. I said we have a twofold issue when it comes to energy security. OPEC, as a collective, acts as a monopolist in the oil market, but that wouldn't be so important if not for the petroleum-only vehicle. It's the petroleum-only vehicle that allows OPEC to act as a monopolist in the transportation fuel market. And that's the cause of many of our national security issues, because frankly, if oil was not basically the only fuel that we can use to move people and goods from one place to another, then it would not be a strategic commodity. Then we would not care about what happens in the Middle East. Then excess profits would not go to Saudi Aramco and to other OPEC companies and regimes and royal families. And we would be facing much less of a threat. And our economy wouldn't be bleeding at the rate that it is. It's the petroleum-only vehicle that gives OPEC its monopoly position in the transportation fuel market, and this monopoly position has to be broken. And in order to break this monopoly position, one of the things the ethanol industry, as an industry, has to think about: are you satisfied with being an additive, or do you want to be a substitute product? Because if all you want to be is an additive, then you'll keep fighting about increasing the blend wall a little bit here, a little bit there. Keep fighting about carving out a little chunk of the market for you, a bigger, bigger chunk every year. But if you want to be a substitute product, then you need to make sure that most new cars sold in this country are fuel-flexible vehicles. And if you want to have any chance of accomplishing that politically, then you need to join forces with the natural gas and coal industries. Because flex fuel vehicles can use a variety of alcohols. Today, the flex fuel vehicles that GM and Ford and so forth sell in the US are warranted only to use gasoline and ethanol. But it's not any significantly more expensive to warrant them to use gasoline, ethanol, and methanol. And methanol should be your biggest ally, especially today with record low natural gas prices. The reason is this: if you look at the Senate and the House, when you look at the Commerce Committee in the Senate, and those of you that heard me speak at the ACE conference heard me say this a couple years ago, and you look at the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House, and you see in the Senate Chairman Rockefeller, coal state, don't think he particularly cares about ethanol one way or another. And if you look at the subcommittee of the Energy Committee in the House that's responsible for this particular issue, that would be responsible for enacting a requirement that most new cars sold in this country allow fuel choice, that's Whitfield, also from a coal state. So you need to be able to work with the coal and the natural gas folks. And these are commodities from which the alcohol methanol can be made. I think that if you ally together, then it would make a huge difference for the national security and the prosperity of the United States. You know, during the 1860s, a $2.08 a gallon tax was imposed on ethanol. Not $2.08 in today's prices. $2.08 in 1860s dollars. Okay, you understand how immense that level of taxation was. So in the 1860s, a $2.08 tax was imposed on ethanol to pay for the Civil War, actually a sin tax on alcohol. And at that time, cars weren't an issue. But ethanol, you may or may not know, was a major fuel for lamps. And that $2.08 tax on ethanol basically killed it as a fuel for lamps and allowed kerosene to rise and become the dominant fuel for lamps. Fast forward into the early 20th century, to the time of Teddy Roosevelt, trust busting. Listen to his speeches And you'll hear him say a very interesting thing. We have to carve out, we have to repeal that tax, still existent, decades later, more than a half century later, on ethanol, at least as it applies to non-beverage purposes, in order to break the monopoly that the oil industry has over our transportation fuel sector, because it's giving it an unfair advantage. So this issue has been going on for a very, very, very long time. Now, it didn't have the national security ramifications that it has today, way back then. But it certainly was an uncompetitive market then, and it is an uncompetitive market today. And if we think about how to make it a competitive market, then we get back to the fact that the only way to drop the price of oil down is to place it in arbitrage against other energy commodities. The only way to do that is if consumers can go to the pump and make an on-the-fly choice what to put in their car, depending on comparative pricing. Now, as long as ethanol is an additive, what happens when oil price goes up? Gasoline prices goes up. And when gasoline prices go up, what happens to gasoline consumption? It goes down. And if you're an additive, when gasoline consumption goes down, then ethanol consumption goes down. But if you're a substitute fuel, if cars are open to fuel competition, then what happens when oil prices go up and gasoline prices go up? Then sales of substitute products go up as sales of gasoline go down, right? Overall sales of transportation fuel don't go down. That's a situation that we need to be in. That's a situation that we need to be in. And politically, what has happened over the past couple years with the revolution in unconventional natural gas is we're seeing prices of natural gas that are actually unsustainable for the industry. They're too low to be profitable. And so the natural gas industry desperately needs a new source of demand to uptake that gas and drive prices up to a more sustainable level, to a profitable level. The natural gas industry is going to be looking for a source of demand. Now, yeah, they went up to the hill and begged for subsidies for converting trucks and light-duty vehicles to run on CNG. They're not going to get them in a fiscally constrained situation that we're seeing on the Hill. And while natural gas prices are low, if you're looking at a light-duty vehicle, it's very, very expensive to allow that car to run on compressed natural gas. And I don't believe it's going to get inexpensive, because you're looking at a fuel tank that no matter what happens to the car, has to be able to withstand that impact. And so you're seeing a price premium of almost $10,000. Now, I think it can go down to $5,000, but I don't see it going down below $5,000. So the natural gas industry, looking at the light-duty vehicle sector, at the vehicles that use gasoline, is going to need to think of another source of demand for their product. And that perfect source of demand is methanol, because it's an alcohol, just like ethanol, that you can use in flex fuel cars. And so there is really an opportunity here for a political alliance, because they have a desperate need, and you have a very good understanding of the tremendous potential that alcohol has to lower prices for consumers, to stop the bleeding of wealth because of oil price spikes, and to create tremendous domestic jobs. But you are limited to really, let's face it, what, 8 senators? In terms of the people that are truly supportive of ethanol in the Senate? This is not a battle you can win on your own. There's been a bill that's been reintroduced year after year after year, session after session, I should say, the open fuel standard. It's a bill that would ensure new cars are gasoline, ethanol, methanol, flexible, most new cars. It's actually technology neutral, so if automakers want to go to vehicle electrification or anything else, they can do that. But obviously the lowest cost thing to do is liquid fuel choice. But that bill is simply not getting out of the barn. And it's not getting out of the barn because while there has been some, you know, lip service support for it, the industry has not put its full weight and its full energy into pushing this bill forward. And I would say as long as you think about your industry in a vacuum, which goes together with thinking of it as an additive, which goes together with thinking about being a big fish in a small pond, and you don't kind of reshift your thinking to being a small fish in a very large pond, and that small fish is bigger than the big fish in the small pond, then you're not going to have the impact, the desperately needed impact, on the safety and security of the United States as a whole that you really could and ought to have. It's very, very important for the whole country that the ethanol industry as a whole be engaged in this fight. Because the consequences of not being engaged in this fight, and the fight is not raising to E15 and then to E20 and then to E25 and then to E30. The fight is opening cars to fuel competition so that commodities can fight against each other over market share in the transportation fuel market. Because the situation that we have today, I think about it this way. Let's say you have severe food allergies, and you're allergic to soy, and you're allergic to rice, and you're allergic to sheep's milk, really everything. The only thing you can have is cow's milk, but you have to start every day with a cup of coffee and some milk in it. Well, if cow milk goes to $100 a gallon, you still can't put anything else in your car, in your in your tummy. You know, and then that's the situation that we're facing with our cars today. Our cars are allergic to everything else. It doesn't matter how economic the other fuels are. It doesn't matter how cheap they are. Why would an investor drastically expand capacity in something if the car can't use that fuel? Well, you're seeing that today. Facing a blend wall or facing the limits of the RFS, why would you expand capacity way beyond that if there's no possibility to sell that fuel into the market? The cars are the key here. The cars are the absolute key. And I implore you, for the sake of the United States, to focus on that fight. Because if we don't open cars to fuel competition, I really think that our future is very, very bleak.